Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for spring semester 2022. Today, cost of capital. Just a quick look at the markets before we begin. As you can see, this is kind of I wouldn't necessarily call it a terrible bear day. The Dow is down about 0.5%. S&P 500 down not nearly as much. And the NASDAQ is actually trying to eke out a gain for the day. So whatever there is, as far as news goes, it's not good at all for the big, huge companies, not very good for the S&P 500 type companies. But you get down to the smallest companies, it's sort of like a whatever kind of day for them. They're not really excited one way or the other. But there's clearly no major equity flow, no capital flowing into equities. And as you can see over here, crude's down a little bit. Yay for that. But man, that volatility is killing. But gold and silver are down, so there's money flowing out of those. And we go over here, 10-year bond yield is down 2.5 basis points, so that means the price is up. So there's money going into bonds today, sort of a first stage flight to quality, nothing huge, but money is flowing out of stocks to some extent, and it's going over there to bonds. But still, if you look at the volume on the S&P 500, those 500 stocks, good grief. I mean, right now, I mean, we're well more than halfway through the day, and it's just sitting there. We've got only about, probably we'll get no more than half of the typical volume. That's that really creepy thing that's going on. The quiet is just almost unnerving. The large investors are staying off the playing field, just waiting to see what's going to happen next. And it kind of, I don't know, historically that kind of sometimes means that there's going to be a major sell-off down the road, but it just doesn't seem like anyone's got the motivation to do anything up or down right now. So I guess in a way that's good news, but as far as the yield curve is concerned, give me a second here. Let me find the yield curve. There we go. Just have a quick look. Oh, my. It's down. It's gotten down that knot. See that 7-10-year inversion? It's just getting worse. I mean, day to day, it's like, wow. I mean, that's just like, holy cats. Oh, wait. Yeah, there we go. It's gone from 5 and 5. Well, it went from 4. Yeah, see, 4 to 5 to 5. And now it's to 6. So the inversion isn't smoothing itself out and getting itself right. It's just getting deeper, which, you know, just sort of establishes more concern that, yeah, this is going to be a recession. There is no question that that's what's happening. Oh, get off. What the heck? Okay, so there's that. As I had said before, I don't foresee it to be a significant one, yeah?
What does a double inversion mean, like
18? Oh, it's like having brain and liver cancer. I mean, one or the other is bad, but will you have them both? Yeah. No, actually, let me not be facetious about it. Yeah, that's. I saw a double inversion twice in my time, and both were meaning very bad recession. And I am still a little bit. I'm not a bull. I'm never a bull, but I mean, I'm still not totally bearish. I don't think we're coming to the apocalypse. Yeah, there's just too much capacity that slack capacity that needs to pick up. There's still good news on a number of fronts. And even in a war scenario, if we were to get into a significant war, that's actually going to be positive in the short run for the economy. So let's all root for a big war and, you know, all of that. But I just don't see the factors. But yeah, that's usually a really bad sign. I don't know. Yeah, double inversion. That'll keep me up at night. But anyway, let me get off that for a while. The first thing in cost of capital. And I'm going to do this. The two big pieces of capital are equity and debt. Now, each of these has some subdivisions in it. And there are equations. You just write them down and stick the numbers in. Don't make it too hard on yourself to do these kinds of things. It's not terribly complicated, but there is a back story here, because in this process, we are actually seeing one of the most fundamental differences between accounting and finance. Now, most people would agree with accountants that profit is good. In finance, well, profit really doesn't mean much, but if you want to give it some meaning, you would say that it is actually a cost of the firm. Equity is a cost just as much as debt is. Your stockholders are a cost to you. They are, if you are a corporation, a legal entity under the law, and all that kind of stuff, those stockholders are a cost. You owe them, you the corporation, as an entity of your own with an FEIN and articles of incorporation, the charter and all that kind of stuff, you owe them your profit, your retained earnings, as it were. That belongs to them. That doesn't belong to you. So it doesn't seem that way, that ownership is a cost. But in general, yeah, it is a cost. You own a car. It's an ugly car, but it's a car. But you see, that car is a cost. Well, yeah, the gas. No, I'm talking about the car itself. Well, I own it. I paid for it. Exactly. You don't feel the cost of it at all. But suppose that that car suddenly became a classic. It's worth $200,000, but you still keep it. You see, then you would feel that cost. It is an opportunity cost, and you would react to that opportunity cost by selling that thing as fast as you could on Craigslist. You would get real, well, maybe something better than that. You see, we don't feel that ownership cost, but it is there. In everything we own, there's an opportunity cost. And the opportunity cost in equity is the retained earnings. They hurt. They actually have a cost. In fact, the cost of equity is the largest of the costs of a normal firm. It is actually, you have to climb the debt ladder quite a ways before you get to the point where debt is so risky that it meets the cost of equity. It's actually a very big cost. Now, debt. Let me do debt here for a minute. The nice thing about debt is that when you borrow as a corporation, you get to deduct the interest from your taxes. So if we wrote R sub D as the cost of debt, then actually what we care about is the after-tax cost of debt, which is the cost of debt to the firm times 1 minus the tax rate. Debt is cheap for two reasons. For heaven's sakes, this is something I can frame on a quiz or an exam. Debt is cheap in two ways. One is that because your lenders have the prior claim to cash flows, that makes them have a safer position. So that makes debt cheaper than equity. The other thing is this after-tax thing. You get to deduct your interest from your taxable income before you calculate your taxes. You don't get to do that with stock. That dividend is paid out after you've paid your stock. Now, after you've paid all your debts in a timely manner, whatever you owe at the given time. So, and it's even worse than that, because if you give a dividend out, then not only did you already pay tax on that before it went out as a dividend, the person who gets it pays tax on that dividend too, which is absolute crap. You know, you're getting it's sort of a double taxation effect. So that makes equity even more expensive, because shareholders will say, look, you were going to pay me 8%. That's what would be fair. But because I have to pay tax on it, then you have to pay me a little more to make it back to the 8%. So it gets to be kind of nasty. And I'll get to that. This is a little bit of a story here. But cost of debt. Well, here's the thing. How do you tell the cost of debt? Well, the easiest way, the cheap shot way of doing it, the cost of debt would be, okay, we just look at the coupon. But you would want to look at the coupon on the last debt. Well, I've got senior subordinated, junior subordinated. Which coupon are you talking about? You would talk about the coupon on the last debt. In other words, anything you do after this is going to be junior, subordinated, or worse than that. So that's going to be the coupon that you would want to use. But it's even worse than that. It's not really the coupon that matters. It's what the market says the coupon should be at a given time. In other words, the yield to maturity. So that R sub D, technically, you should look at the yield to maturity on the most expensive debt that the firm is carrying. So if you look at some company like CVS, you just go down the line and look at all their instruments outstanding. You find the riskiest one, because you're going to borrow, the next time you borrow, it's going to be at that riskiest. And you look at the yield on that debt. That's what you're going to have to pay if you go out and get more debt, because that's what the market says you should be paying now. So if CVS has 3% coupon bonds, that's their most expensive coupon on a bond. You look at the yield to maturity and it's 3.4%, that is the cost of debt. In other words, what they call in economics the marginal cost of debt, the worst cost that you'll bear, because that's what the market says the company should be paying. So if you go out there and borrow again, they're going to say at least 3.4%. So in other words, the R sub D you should use is the yield to maturity, not the coupon. And then you take 1 minus the tax rate. Notice something interesting here. Historically, and I think I said this before, but historically, the high taxes, the highest marginal tax rate that corporations have ever paid, rich people and corporations, was 90%. That was long, long before your time. Almost before my time, even. And then it went to 70%. Corporations crying, well, it's terrible what you do to us rich people and to corporations. And then it kept going down, and finally it stabilized some years back at 39% as the highest top marginal tax bracket for the big, huge corporations. But then in 2017, a massive tax cut benefiting the wealthy and large corporations came into effect, dropping the highest tax rate to 21%. So in other words, the 1 minus T that you would use now, if you're talking about large corporations, would be 1 minus 0.21 or 0.79. Now notice what that does, though. That's kind of an interesting thing, because at the same time that it's taking away the tax burden from corporations and letting them keep more of their money and all that good stuff, it's also making the after-tax cost of debt higher for corporations than it ever has been before, since federal taxes came in almost a century ago, around a century ago. So that it has kind of a counter effect. Interestingly enough, in a few weeks, I'm going to show you another perverse effect of lowering the taxes on corporations. It tends to take away their incentive to invest in new projects, interestingly enough. With high taxes, they'll take on lots of new projects to keep from paying taxes. But if you lower the tax rate as hard as we did this time, it's taking away a large amount of the incentive corporations, large corporations would have to create new products, to start new things, and to hire more people for those new things. So there's that. But overall, the cost of debt is, after taxes, that's the one you use. The yield to maturity times 1 minus the tax rate. Now, if you don't have a YTM, if all you have is a coupon, use the coupon. Right? 8% coupon, whatever it is. And you've seen me do those. And that's about the story of debt. Debt is the easy one. There is a little bit of a twist on it, though, and I hinted at this just a few minutes ago. As a corporation takes on more debt, naturally, the R sub D is going to go up because the corporation is getting riskier. In other words, you are not going to have a flat amount R sub D. As you acquire more debt in your capital structure, it gets more expensive. Let me give you an example of that from my own corporation. Every year I do essentially it's like a revolving line of credit. At the beginning of the year, at some point in the year, I go to the bank, I'd like a line of credit to build my inventory, and then through the exhibition season, I pay it off. And then I'm flat again, and we go to the next year, and I do the floor plan. A lot of many, many companies do this. Furniture companies, auto dealerships, boat companies, anything where they borrow a lot of money at the beginning, and then through the year, they pay it off as revenues come in. But you need to borrow the money up front to get through the lean months and get your inventory built up and all that. Okay, now. Here's how it works with mine for the last year. My line of credit was, okay, up to $10,000, it's 8.99%. From $10,000 to $15,999, it is 12.99%. Anything above $16,000 and above that I borrow, that comes off at 20% flat. So in other words, the more I borrow, the last amount that I borrow has a higher and higher interest rate, simply because as I borrow more, there's a greater likelihood that my revenues will not be able to cover it, and they'll be exposed to default risk. That R sub D from time we did a while back. So yeah, this R sub D doesn't sit there just looking at you. It's going to be, and that's what I was hinting at before. Equity is more expensive than debt. However, if you take on too much debt, it actually will get worse than equity. So there's somewhere in there, there's a balance between debt and equity that a corporation needs to find to get the minimum weighted average cost of capital. Now, I'm going to define this later, so don't sweat it now. But that perfect balance is called the optimal capital structure. And companies actually bust their butts to maintain the optimal capital structure. They actually do. They work hard to keep that right where it is at its lowest, where the cost of debt and the cost of equity are pretty much the same. You gathered so much debt that it is as expensive as equity. Now let me get over here to equity for a while. Equity comes in so many flavors, it's stupid. When you say stock, well, that's only one kind of equity. One way that we can divide it is between preferred and common. preferred stock is actually pretty darn cheap. I mean, it's pretty, actually surprisingly cheap. Now, I'm going to bring up something later. Even with flotation costs, which really isn't as common as typical as they talk about in some books, preferred is actually a fairly cheap form of capital, of raising capital. If you issue preferred stock, it's not too costly. It's kind of like a burden to the company because you've got to pay that dividend forever, and it's a fixed dividend forever. But, you know, there's that. And then there's common stock. Common stock is risky AF. It is really, really risky. It's nasty stuff. It's expensive. The question always comes up, why is this corporation doing an IPO? Why is it issuing common stock? That's the most expensive kind of stock, kind of capital you can raise. It can be twice as expensive in some cases, or more than that, than borrowing money. You got a yield to maturity on your debt of, let's say, 7.5%. Your cost of equity could be somewhere around 15, 20%. Why do companies do it if it's so darned expensive? Well, there are some reasons why they do it and some reasons why they shouldn't do it, that they do it, and all of that. But there's another thing, too. Common stock. There are two different flavors. There is internally generated equity, and there is externally generated equity. Explain. There's this weird thing corporations can do. It's kind of crazy. They can actually make money. They can actually have a profit. They can actually raise money by doing what they are supposed to do. Get a profit at the bottom line. Retained earnings, all that kind of stuff. Externally generated equity is when you sell stock to raise money. So in other words, a company actually, ideally, from year to year, month to month, it should be able to survive on what it actually makes internally. This money belongs to the shareholders, retained earnings. But this is it's only in an extraordinary circumstance that a company would raise money externally, sell more common stock. And that is more expensive than the internally generated version. You'll see why in a little bit here. But I mean, this externally generated equity, sell stock, do an IPO, do a seasoned offering, whatever you want to call it. When you sell stock to the public, that's or someone, a private placement, whatever, that is externally generated equity. It is terribly expensive. It's more expensive than the internally generated equity, which is expensive anyway. Now, a lot of books and common language says retained earnings, this internally generated equity is retained earnings. Your profit, and then you subtract your dividends, and that adds to your beginning retained earnings, and then you get your plus income profit minus dividends. That's your retained earnings at the end of the period. So a loose and incorrect term for internally generated equity, but you'll see it even in the book, is retained earnings. There's a famous old story that goes around where they were at a corporate meeting. They had some executives, and they had some junior executives there, and they were talking about a new project and how they were going to finance it. And at some point, one of the junior executives piped up and he said, well, why don't we just finance it with retained earnings? And the CFO said, I'll tell you what I want you to do, son. I want you to go find our checking account that says retained earnings. You bring that checkbook back to me that says retained earnings, and we'll write a check out of that. Well, I don't think we have exactly that. Then don't ever say we use retained earnings. It doesn't exist. It just doesn't exist. What the closest we have is our free cash flow. Free cash flow is the way that you can finance projects. That's your internally generated equity. But for the most part, we use a sloppy term called retained earnings. Now, let me go on with this. First of all, preferred cost of preferred. Equity. This is just a formula. Use the stupid formula, okay? I'll give you a caution about this, though, in a minute here. Cost of preferred equity. Earlier in the course, I did this thing where the price right now of preferred, right now the zero preferred, is the dividend that it pays over the expected return to preferred. That's all. That's all it is. Just that right there, that formula. So, CNB 1.5% preferred par value $50 per share. Okay. Well, that means the dividend is 1.5% times 50. So your dividend is 0.75. Now here's where the wild card comes in. If the cost of preferred, earlier in the semester, you would have just been given, use an R of this amount, 0.015, 0.20, whatever. If I turn this around, the cost of preferred can be calculated, just take the dividend divided by the current price of the stock. That's all you do. The price of the CNB is currently $48 per share. Okay, well then, the cost of preferred right now is going to be the dividend, 75 cents, divided by the current price, $48. That's all there is to it. Nothing complicated at all. It's probably the easiest one of all to do. So I just take 75 cents divided by 48. It's about 15.625%. I'm sorry, 1.562. Cost of preferred, right there. Generally, this number will be a relatively small percentage. It could be a little more than the dividend, could be a little less than the dividend, but it's somewhere in that area. That's the nice thing about preferred is that it fluctuates very slowly. It's like bonds. It just kind of moves around its pivot point, the par value of the stock, very slowly. Just like bonds generally stay near $1,000. Preferred normally stays right around its par value, and so that cost of preferred generally tends to be very stable over time. Nothing hard about that. Okay, here comes the nastier one. The cost of internally generated equity. Okay. There are three ways you can do this, and I will be very clear on a test about which one you use. One way you can do it is to use the CAPM. You can use the capital asset pricing model. One, you'll need the beta of the stock, obviously. The expected return to common stock is going to be the risk-free rate plus the beta of the stock times expected return to the market portfolio, which you can get from services, minus the risk-free rate, which you can get from that table that I look at every day with you. And there it is, right there. You can do it that way. I mean, there is a problem with this way of doing it. Kind of a big problem. If it's a large company, you can look up the beta, get an estimate of the return to the market portfolio, get the risk-free rate as a T-bill, 1-year T-bill rate, whatever you want. And there you go. You've got your cost of equity. That's what it'll be. The problem comes in, what if this company is too new to have a beta? Or what if it's a private company that wouldn't have a beta because there's no stock data on it? Well, then you're in trouble. The best you could do if you want to use the CAPM approach would be to use comparables. Find some companies that are comparable to this company's operations. That are public companies that have betas. And then, I mean, you could just kind of add them up and take the average, and that's the beta that you would use. So you can do it that way. It's kind of a shot in the dark, but it is a way that you could actually get the cost of the internally generated equity. I mean, it's there, and it's used. That's the one that's used. Now, notice something interesting about that, though. Do you see that if, for example, the risk of the company goes up, then the cost of internally generated equity goes up. So as a company gets riskier, its cost of equity goes up. As a company gets safer, its cost of equity goes down. Another thing, notice that if the expected return to the market portfolio begins to go up, that's going to tend to push the cost of equity capital up too. Now, this one is used, but I don't know. Thinking on it, I don't know if I've seen a whole lot of companies use this way of calculating the cost of equity capital, internally generated capital. I just don't remember too much. I've got a couple of examples in my mind, but there are other ways that it can be done. The next way is to reverse the dividend growth model. Remember that the price right now of common stock would be the D1 over R minus G. You remember that way of calculating for a company where the D1 is D0 times 1 plus G? I mean, you can do it this way. What you would do is you would rearrange this, put the R minus G over here, put the P0 under there, and then add the G back, and you would get that the cost of common stock would be D1 over the price of the stock plus G. So I'll put it here in straight form. like that. This is such a gimme on the test. Don't make this problem as a word problem can look like it's really hard. Just pull the stupid numbers out for the variables and put them into the formula and you've got your answer. So try not to make this one too hard. So for example, CNB common will pay a $2 per share dividend next year and the current price of the stock is $10 per share, and the growth rate is 5%. So go ahead and write that down. Okay. So I could say that the cost of internally generated equity of stock would be D1. I gave you the D1. I said next year, so that's the D1, $2 per share divided by the current price, $10, plus the growth rate of 0.05. .20 plus .05 is 25%. That's all there is to it. Don't make this one a hard one. It's like I said, I can write a problem that looks kind of complicated. Just pull the numbers out and put them in the right slots in the formula and you've got your answer. That's it. That's all there is to it. Now, there's one other way that it's done. This one is actually really popular. It's they say that the cost of the common stock is the bond yield plus a risk premium. Here's how they do it. They look at a bunch of companies. They say, all right, for companies like this one, the average bond yield is about, well, let's say, 8%. And then they'll go to something like a Standard & Poor's table and they'll say, what is the cost of equity for this typical company? Average R sub S is 14%. That means that the market is putting on equity a risk premium of 6% over bonds. They say, okay, what is the average yield that bonds of this companies are paying? Well, it's about 8%. Okay. Well, what's their cost of equity capital? Well, overall, it's running about 14% right now. Well, that would mean that there is a 6% premium for equity cost for the risk in equity over the risk of bonds. So we would just simply take this company's bond yield and we would add the 6% premium to it. That's all we would do. Suppose that's CNB, what was CNB? Well, I didn't do one for that one. CNB yield to maturity on their worst bonds right now is 10%. Overall, the risk premium for equity for companies like CNB is 6%. So that would mean that the cost of equity for CNB right now is running about 16%. Now, which way is right? Depends on who you ask, whom you ask. Which one is the most popular? That one right there, that bottom one, is the one that's overwhelmingly used these days because it's so easy to get the answer. It's so easy. Quite literally, it's not, is it theoretically right? Well, theory is kind of a little bit rough here because you've got these different. Now, one thing that I was kind of curious about myself, what does number three and number one, see, number two actually has a problem. If a company doesn't pay dividends, well, that's a bad thing right there. So you can't really use it in practice for some companies. And estimating the growth rate, whatever. But which one is, between one, the CAPM, and three, the bond yield plus risk premium, do they give about the same answer? Actually, yeah, pretty close. Not perfect, but they're pretty close. So you got some confidence there. Now, this was the cost of internally generated equity. I want you to notice something, two things. And I'll ask this on a test. I will ask this. You see that? Look at the formula. Look at number two. That's the one that gives us the most insight in some ways. Do you see that if a company's market price of its stock goes down, its cost of equity increases? I saw this in practice, a lack of understanding of this. There was a board meeting where I was a consultant, and I was at the board meeting, and I commented, oh, the stock price is going down really bad right now. And the president and CEO said, well, that's not our problem, where it goes, you know, the price. Well, yeah, it is, because that's increasing your cost of equity. And I said that, and he said, well, I don't feel it. Do any of you feel it? Well, that's just the thing. It's like a fever. It's not right there on the surface. It's not like some tumor sitting on your face. It's just that the cost of your shareholders is getting worse and worse. You will see it the next time you try to sell stock in an offering. You'll feel it. Geez, we could have sold this at $15 a year ago, and now we're selling it at $10 a share. Wow, how did that happen? Well, there's that cost of equity. You made it go up because you weren't trying to keep the stock price high. And so as the stock price slid, well, that increased your cost of equity. But there's another thing in here that's kind of odd. Do you see that as a company grows faster, its cost of equity goes up? See the plus G? As a company grows faster, its cost of equity goes up. What's the logic of that? Because faster growth is higher risk. Faster growth is higher risk. Higher risk requires a higher expected return to the shareholders. This company is growing really fast. Wow, hot damn. Well, that's going to increase their cost of equity a lot. So be cautious about fast growth. Yes, it's wonderful, but eventually you actually want your growth to slow down. A company like Target, in its early years, grew fast. But now that it has matured, its growth has slowed. Hence, its cost of equity goes down as a result of that. In the early days of Microsoft, it was growing rapidly, and the cost of equity was just staggering. But as it grew and grew, it couldn't grow all that much faster, and so its cost of equity began to ease back. The same is true of Apple. Yeah.
These formulas, using the letter R, what is
cost of it. That's cost.
Okay.
Yeah.
We wouldn't use something like, I don't know, C.
Are you trying to be difficult with a logical? But no, yeah, you're right. You know, it's funny because it is a cost. And there's even more to it than that. Most people don't think of a cost in terms of a percentage. They think of it in dollar terms, like a C. You're absolutely right about that. It's kind of odd because we're talking about cost in terms of a percentage, an R, an interest rate.
Would it be fair to say it's R because it's like the rate of cost almost, or no?
The rate. R as rate. That was, you know what? You're asking me something. I've used R my whole darned life. I think it is. The R is usually a rate. That's what it was. The R came from, was rate. And why we didn't use C was that it was not a dollar value. It was a percentage value. Like, interestingly enough, what is the cost of labor? It's actually, interestingly enough, we use a dollar term for that. For you, $20. But actually, that's not a cost in the common sense. It's a rental. I'm not buying you, I'm renting you. And in terms of the analysis, I would talk about that cost in terms of a percentage. What is the rental rate of human capital versus the rental rate of a machine? See, because usually we talk about, and what's the rental rate of dollar capital? We have to put them all in the same term. Oddly enough, we use R because it's a rate, a percentage. You would never see, I don't think you'd ever see a cost of equity as a rental. Now, there's one more. This is the cost of existing. This is the cost of your existing shareholders. Suppose your stock is $50 a share. That actually, if you went out and sold more stock, the company would not get $50 a share. It would get something less than that. It would get you whatever the 50 minus whatever the investment bankers took for their scratch. And you've got to remind me, did I tell you the story of Made in America? Okay, I will tell you that next time because it has to do with the flotation cost. That's all I have for you today, though. I thank you.